Okay, and welcome back. Dr. Ray Keller is here again tonight. Always fun to talk to Ray. He's got so many things that he has worked on over the years, met some fabulously interesting people, and he shares that with us. So when you look over on the right-hand side, you find Dr. Raymond Keller under Featured Stories, and you can enjoy our past visits and look at the images and all that. This program was, I think, probably the first to start integrating online images with guests, and we did that a long time ago. It's been a lot of fun. Okay, Ray, where do you want to go next now?
Yes, we can take a look at this article by the sci-fi, famous sci-fi writer and comic book creator and ufologist, the author of 5 UFO books, Otto Binder.
Okay, which part would that be? Part one, I believe, huh? The Venus conspiracy documents. Let me take a look.
It will be. It'll be the alien messages.
The second group, number one. Okay. Now, if my computer will cooperate. Okay. So look under Dr. Ray Keller. 1, 2, 3. Number four is alien messages file number one. So let's click on that. Okay, ET messages from the Otto Binder binder. That's kind of cute. All right, so what do we have here? Tell us.
Okay, well, Otto Binder was the creator of the Marvel family, Captain Marvel and Miss Marvel, also Supergirl.
Marvel Comics.
This was... Captain Marvel.
Yes. Okay.
Back in the early days of comic books, and he was also a
isn't very that funny famous... how the name of the comic book company was later on Marvel Comics?
Yes. There was a lot of litigation over the use of these characters and these names in the early days of. Of comicdom, and there's an excellent book. It's called Otto Binder, The Life and Work of a Comic Book and Science Fiction Visionary. It's by Bill Shelley, and that book is available on Amazon, and it's really good. It tells about all the characters that that he was created, as well as his involvement with ufology. But what ties him into just kind of getting off the track here a little bit, what tied him in intimately with August C. Roberts, the one who took the pictures for...
at Howard Menger's farm for the outdoor UFO meeting in July of 1958, August Roberts, the photographer.
Yes, that photographer. He was working with Otto Binder on several UFO books, and so I have the outlines of those books that never got published. And
so you have the actual sketches of the storyline. You have all that.
Yes, I have the whole thing. But I'm doing a book follow ups to the Venus trilogy, and those are going to be in there. But on your site, I published just the one of the title pages with an initial outline for a couple of the chapters, so that people can see that August C. Roberts was indeed working with Otto Binder on these projects.
Would that be Alien Messages 2 or 3, one of those?
No, that was back on the previous program that we were doing.
Okay.
About the Valiant Thor. And I just wanted to show that Otto Binder and August C. Roberts were working closely together, so that they would understand where the Valiant Thor photos came from.
That still amazes me. When you look at how those people were dressed, Val Thor and his three fellow Venusians, They were just dressed to the nines. I mean, immaculately dressed in a, and it was a July, a warm afternoon, and they go out to this farm for an outdoor open air meeting, a UFO meeting at Howard Menger's farm. We've covered that on the program. And those photographs that August Roberts took continually amaze me. When you look at those people and you look at everyone else there and how many of the others that are there are staring at them. I mean, they stuck out like a sore thumb.
They did compared to the casual manner in which everyone else was dressed, including Howard
right.
Menger.
Yeah, fascinating. Okay, so what we're looking at in Alien Messages number one, ET Messages from the Auto Binder Binder. What are we going to see here? What are we going to talk about?
Oh, okay, that first page is just introducing him as the creator of these comic book characters and his involvement with UFOs. And then on page two of the article, it's taken from the January 1971 issue, volume 41, number 4 of Saga magazine, which was a prominent men's magazine in the 60s and 70s.
Oh, Saga, Argosy, True. I've seen stories about all those magazines. That was a whole little era.
And not only Auto Binder, but the famous paranormal investigator and ufologist John A. Keel wrote numerous articles
uh-huh.
for this thing. And as well as the magazine True, which was going back a little further, back into the 50s, Donald E. Kehoe of famous NICAP fame, National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, which was the largest UFO group. He wrote a series of articles in the True magazine.
Those were kind of thought about in a way that, in a contemporary sense, we think about the National Enquirer, the Weekly World News, but not quite so raggy. But people today, I think if you understand what the National Enquirer is, you'll know it's an intelligence, CIA most likely, owned and operated disinformation, or it's a disseminator of real information. It has a lot of good material in it. That's the funny part. And those magazines, from what you're saying, had some very high quality, very knowledgeable people writing for them.
They certainly did, Jeff. And as I followed up on articles in the Enquirer related to research in the Soviet Union about extraterrestrial life back in the day, I found that everything in there was true, because you'd follow up in scientific journals published by the Soviet Academy of Science
uh-huh.
and so forth. And everything in there was a real quote by real scientists, and it was all verifiable, including this one about the that we were looking at before about the scorpion-like creature. There really is a scientist who said all those things, and it was published in a very respectable journal in Russia.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. Alien Messages, file number one. These are with messages from the Auto Binder Binder. So there's not a whole lot of text here. You talk about meeting Frank and George in New Jersey. Is there something else we want to look at on this page?
Yes. On the second page, though, there should be four squares.
Okay, I'm going to have to go. This is short. I put everything I could figure out up on this one. We'll go to Alien Messages, file number two. And that's got a drawing of a craft, it looks like. Doesn't have four squares.
That would be page three.
Okay, I'm missing
the one with the craft. Page two is missing. It's got four squares there, and the first square underneath it, it says EST picked up this Martian alphabet in Geneva from 1894 to 1896.
Wow. All right, well, I'll have to get hold of the rest of that. That's all I got. I put up everything I had. So we'll finish that up and people can look at it.
Okay. Yeah, that should be on there if they can find that. But as long as you have the one about the craft on page, which is page 3 of that report, we can turn to that.
Yeah, that's actually would be Alien Messages number 2, right?
Oh, okay. That one.
From the George Adamski contact of 12/3/52.
Yes. This is a photograph plate that was delivered to Adamski following a photograph taken on a previous encounter, in which the film of the Venusian scout ship at a close range was confiscated, and then when Orthon met Adamski again, returned the film, and it had this cryptic drawing on it, and allegedly it pertains to the propulsion system.
Well, it looks like some kind of handwriting, symbols, and a drawing of a craft, cutaway drawing, so to speak. You can see through it. I don't know what it's sitting on. It's sitting on a block.
Yes, it's some kind of rotor or something.
Yeah, there's something inside it. It would appear to be something that does rotate.
Yes.
Well, and the handwriting is, who supposedly wrote this? We don't know.
It's supposed to be in a Venusian alphabet.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yes, but there is an explanation for it in Adamski's first book, Flying Saucers Have Landed, published in London in 1953.
Okay. So we have a link to that, too.
Yes, there's a link there. That's Saturday Night Euphoria, which looks back at the history of ufology and particularly contactees, and has some nice photos in there at that website.
I'm going to open that up real quick. Wait a minute. See if it like. I'll have to cut and paste it. That one doesn't want to open. Well, that's worth a look. I have to hand type it. It didn't come across like a hot link. Okay, but it's there. Saturday Night Euphoria. That's kind of a neat name.
Yeah.
All right. So what's next?
On the next page, on page 4, the last page of the article, we see something very interesting where the music from a UFO was put to a musical notation. And
so somebody actually wrote the score to music?
From a UFO, yes.
Did they record the music, or did they just remember it?
It was recorded from transcribed patterns received from radio from the object from beyond the Earth's atmosphere. And then it brought to mind to me, well, that was in 1971. When Otto Binder investigated that incident.
Uh-huh.
And then we'll recall that 6 years later, in 1977, was when the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out.
Mm-hmm.
With the music from the saucers being recorded to play back and communicate in their alphabet, their language, which was a tonal language with the music.
Have you heard this music that we're seeing the musical pages representing? Have you heard that?
No, I haven't. I haven't heard it. But
you need to take that to somebody who knows how to read music and have them play it on the piano.
It would be very interesting to see what that comes to.
On the left is the Close Encounters of the Third Kind score, and I assume there's some parallel here with
just that the we have an extraterrestrial message conveyed through music.
Very good. All right. Well, I'd say find somebody who can read music, Ray, and have them play it.
Yes, it would be wonderful to hear that.
Yeah.
Would...
Is it just that one sheet, or is there more?
No, there's more to it.
Well, you got to get this recorded.
It goes on for about 15 minutes.
Really? There's that much sheet music?
Yes.
Well, we got to get this recorded. Somebody's got to play this.
This would be very interesting to hear it.
Oh, yeah, we'll play it right here. See if you can do that.
All right, I certainly will do that.
That's a request, please. Yeah,
I have sent Frank a typed transcript of Val Thor's notes.
Ah, very good. Well, we can put that up, too.
So he should be sending that to you.
We need the other part of page two. Actually, I could put all these just in one page, couldn't I? Alien messages, file 1, 2, and 3. They're all strung together.
Oh, yes. Yeah, they could all go on one page, and then the missing page, too, could insert it later.
Yeah, all right. Well, as soon as I get that material, I'll have that done. Very good. Now, what do we know about time travel that we want to talk about here?
Okay, there is a... there's a book that's in my possession that I received from a friend from a time traveler.
This sounds mysterious. You know someone who claims to have been a time traveler? Okay, is this an ET? Time traveler.
This is a human being so far as
okay.
So far as I know, but I don't have permission to divulge too much about it, other than that. If you had any questions about time travel, I could certainly look up some of the answers in this book.
The time traveler gave you a book. What kind of book is this? I don't need a name, but is it a homemade book? What is it?
It's a homemade book. But what it does is it explains the variables concerned with time traveling, such as the speed for the rotation. Of the Earth on its axis and its speed and orbiting around the Sun, and different factors that you'd have to take into account when traveling backwards or forwards in time, because it's not that if you would, you know, it's not quite like the movie Back to the Future, where they just go to the same spot automatically on the Earth, because the Earth is moving through space as well as time.
Of course.
So you wouldn't want to end up in the middle of outer space.
And no, so you want to come back to where you started. I got it.
Right, exactly, to where you started. So the book talks about those factors. And then it explains that time travel paradoxes and their origin, and that how paradoxes were actually developed as part of time travel stories, and that they don't really occur, because what happens when you go back in time is that you're slipping into an alternate timeline, a parallel universe.
Okay.
And then it has various physicists and their explanations for the existence of that phenomena.
This person who is a time traveler, have you met this person personally?
Yes, I've seen him.
What does that mean? Across the street? passing by on a train?
No, I've seen him in a room of people.
Okay, close up, in other words.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay, that's fine. Yes. That's all I wanted to know. Interesting. How did he look? What kind of a presence did he cast?
Oh, very scientific. Looks a little bit like that Doc Brown in that movie.
Huh.
Back to the Future.
Uh-huh.
Has a similar appearance.
Eccentric.
Yes.
And was he discoursing on his time travels?
Yes. Yes, that's what he was doing.
What did he say about, this is a big question, of course, can you go back and change things or not? And how many movies have we seen where people have the ability to time travel, they go back and they try like hell, but they can't change things. So things stay the same as we know them now.
Yes, it would take a freak accident in order for you to go back into your own timeline. What would happen is you would go into another timeline in a parallel universe, or it would create a bifurcation in time and space, and you would become a part of that world's history. So you wouldn't necessarily be changing anything because you would be part of it, but it wouldn't alter the continued forward flow of the time period that you happen to be in.
Okay.
Of your own time period.
Uh huh.
So if you came back to 2018 on the Earth in this space time continuum, it wouldn't change anything, but it would have altered a reality in another.
You have to be careful about which reality you're messing with then.
Yes. Yes. I know it sounds incredible,
it doesn't sound that incredible. Nothing does anymore.
That's how temporal mechanics works. You know, that's time. That's how time travel works.
Very good. Okay, hold on, Ray. We'll pause and come back. And another half an hour to go with Dr. Raymond Keller. Welcome back. We are talking to Dr. Ray Keller about some very interesting things. Okay, Ray. So this issue of time travel, it has been around since before H.G. Wells. Do you happen to believe it? And is it something that we can initiate? Or is it something that is initiated by others elsewhere that perhaps comes forward and invites us to take a little trip? How does it work?
Yes, I believe that it can be initiated by us and that others with more advanced technology can certainly do it. Of course, we're all moving forwards in time and traveling into the future. We're doing on a daily basis because that's the forward motion that we're locked into in this space-time continuum. But, because of Einstein's theory of of light and so forth, that the faster we go, the more time actually slows down, at least for us inside inside a spacecraft. We're on the very cusp of exploring this area of time travel, but Wheeler and Oppenheimer and others have told us that it's definitely a possibility that we could travel through time as well as space.
Well, it's okay with me. nothing wrong with that. Very good. Okay. So what else do we have to cover tonight?
Well, we have a very interesting document that I wanted to present for you and your listeners. That vindicates a lot of things that people have heard about George Adamski, but only suspected. Mm-hmm. And it's we're returning to Madeleine Rotifer.
Yes.
Where George Adamski was living when he passed away in 1965, and this is from her home address where she and Adamski were at, and where Val Thor made the appearance to them and photographed that ship.
Yes.
This is this document is. Basically, it's in those years following Adamski's death, when Miss Rotifer continued to present the information that Adamski was collecting and continuing his mission and informing the public about the Venusian presence here on Earth. And as part of her program, it's a bio, and she didn't complete it. She was still working on. There's some editorial comments on there, just inserting some information. But it's not the published one, but it's a typed one.
Did they ever publish anything?
This one, I haven't been able to determine if it was later published, but the bio, it is a bio sheet about George Adamski and the work that that she was doing, and it does state there in the second to last paragraph that she had been, or that Adamski did in fact. In his youth, live in Tibet when he was young for a period of about 6 years.
Really? Hmm.
Okay. And what's interesting to me is that there's this Tibetan connection with all of the contactees and particularly all of those that have anything to do with the planet Venus, and going all the way back to Helena Blavatsky, the founder of the Theosophicals, co-founder of the Theosophical Society.
What did Madame Blavatsky have to say about Venus?
She wrote the book called History of a Planet. She published that short tract in 1877.
Uh-huh.
And she said that... that Venus was the most mysterious, powerful, and occult of all worlds.
Huh.
And that the planet Venus was inhabited by an advanced intelligence with angelic qualities that have visited the Earth over countless millennia. And she wrote about what was known of Venus in history and astronomy up to that time. And then when I wrote Venus Rising, A Concise History of the Second Planet, mm-hmm. I thought, as a member of the Theosophical Society myself, I thought, well, it's time for an updated version of Blavatsky's History of a Planet. And that was my motivation for writing Venus Rising.
Very interesting. Madame Blavatsky.
Yes, Madame Blavatsky, she tried to go to Tibet 2 times, and the world headquarters of the Theosophical Society she established in Madras in India. But on the second time, she did make it into Tibet, where she met with ascended masters, is what she called them.
Well, that whole Theosophy movement was very strange, very unusual. Who was that? Let's see. Krishnamurti was involved with that, wasn't he?
Yes, Colonel Henry Olcott was the co-founder.
Krishnamurti was a child prodigy raised, I think, who raised him? Was it Blavatsky, am I thinking right? Somebody was his parent. He was just an Indian, and he was...
Yes, he was.
I think you can see Krishnamurti on YouTube. I think they probably have some of his... He had a television program. Once a week or something, he'd come on and talk for an hour. Very interesting guy. I used to see those and rewrite. You get them on videotape. But Krishnamurti, M-U-R-T-I.
Yes, his philosophy was based on the Theosophical Society, and I believe later on in life that that he split off from it and formed his own organization.
I think you're right. He ended up living in Ojai, California, I think.
Anyway. Yes.
Very interesting man. Okay, good. So what's next here? We got about 10 minutes or so. Want to make sure we get it all in. You've got so much material. It's fascinating.
Well, I also have collected a lot of material about communications from space by radio.
Uh-huh. Well, that goes into Tesla, right?
Yes, so going all the way back to Tesla, and I write about him in my first book, Venus Rising. I spend a lot of time discussing the history of Tesla, his Tesla scope, the first one created in 1898 and then later perfected. And he believed that he was in communication with other intelligences here in the solar system, and that he had an intimate connection with Venus and the Venusians, and particularly with bees. Bees and doves were long associated with Venus, and he did a lot of interviews and in the 1920s, 1926 in particular, where he talked about the organization of society being patterned after a beehive, and from information that he garnered from his Tesla scope. But moving into the contemporary times, beginning in the 1950s, signals were received from planets in the solar system. Donald E. Kehoe, for example, wrote about radio signals being received from Venus. And in 1955, that was one of the headlines in the Chicago Sun-Times about signals being received that sounded like telegraphy from the surface of Venus.
Right.
Then in the 9th of January of 1955, there were reports of signals coming from Jupiter. There was an article in the Detroit Times about in the Hearst newspaper chain about these signals, and of course Jupiter is a powerful radio source, but these weren't scattered. They were narrowly focused and received by a narrow beam antenna, large radio telescope, and based in Maryland. And so very interesting story there. Jupiter is, of course, the largest planet in our solar system and has 67 moons.
Is it that many? I didn't know it was that many. That's a lot of moons.
Yes, and they've been finding out that that some of these outer planets like Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus have many more moons than we previously suspected, and that they're almost like miniature solar systems in themselves.
Huh. Well, this I didn't know. I didn't know. 60 how many?
64? 67 in around
and,
Jupiter.
And counting.
Then Mars, Saturn, of course, we have the largest moon in the solar system that we know of is Titan.
Right.
And that's a moon almost as big as Mars, which has an Earth-like atmosphere and has photographed lakes and the rivers on its surface and ice fields and mountains and who knows what else is there. But a lot of contactees said that they've met beings from the Saturnian system or that...
Yes, yeah.
That they were reincarnated from that system like Howard Menger did. And then, let's see, I have so many of these different articles here. Okay, experts study radio signals from space. This is April 1968. M. Barrett, a Massachusetts Institute of Technology physicist, said the observation can nevertheless be viewed as suggestive. Many properties of the signals which are generated by hydroxyl radicals, and oxygen atoms are not well accounted for by standard theory. But this is about some kind of signals that were received in the region. Oh, here we go. Radio station WINS reported on February 28, 1968, that radio signals are being received from outer space somewhere in the region of one of the moons of Jupiter at around 10:45 a.m. and 11:30 a.m.
Oh, routine. Okay. How big are some of these moons? Big as our moon?
Yes. Some are bigger, especially the... when Galileo was the first one, the moons of Jupiter were among the first objects that he viewed through his telescope. So Callisto, Io, Ganymede, these are really big, much bigger than our own moon.
They're getting maybe, half the size of our planet. They're big.
Yes, they're big. And
anything could be going on in our solar system.
On the moon of Europa, it's believed to have an ocean underneath there.
I read that, yeah.
And it's not frozen over under the ice crust because the magnetic or the gravitational pull of Jupiter is so intense that it creates enough friction to keep the ocean there in a liquid state.
Wow. You remember when there was a series of, I've seen this magazine somewhere reproduced, Life magazine, and on the cover of Life magazine there were, it seems to me there were three across, pictures of Mars during the year, and it would show what appeared to be, these are telescopic pictures, what appeared to be canals on Mars. And then people said, well, no, they're not canals, they're just vegetation. But there was something that was changing the obvious optical acquisition of that planet to make it look like things were seasonally growing and receding. It was very clear. This was big stuff in the early 50s.
I remember that, and I was a subscriber to the UFO investigator of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. And I remember an article in there by Major Donald E. Kehoe, and he had a plat of railroad lines in the state of Iowa, and he compared that to some photographs from an observatory that were taken. This is before space probes and that,
sure.
but showed this photograph of changing of surface conditions on Mars, and it showed what looked very similar to the to this map, railroad map of Iowa. I thought, well, that was really something.
Yeah, well, you can find these pictures online. Just probably do a search for the canals of Mars. But we had major coverage about this, and the pictures were clear. There, in fact, you could see the Mars polar ice cap, North Pole, very clearly. And these fingers looked like canals, were moved down from the north as the season went from spring to summer. And then, you know, it would recede as it got into fall and winter. And it was like clockwork. No one talks about that anymore.
Yes, it surprises me. And I go back to a lot of that kind of information from previous eras because I don't believe that they're being honest about what's out there. And we have
agree.
To go back there as a base to move forward and find out the real facts.
Well, I think we're already there and we already know, but we're not to be told. We don't deserve to be told.
Jeff, here's the article that I was looking for. This is what Kehoe based his that one section in his book, Flying Saucers from Outer Space, about. This is the Chicago Daily Sun-Times. It's Tuesday, June the 5th, 1956. And it says, speaking of planets, Navy scientists ordered to tune in on Venus and get hot radio reception.
What year was that again?
That was 1956.
There was
It's the article about the telegraphic signal that Kehoe wrote about in his book. So this is the actual article that I followed up on.
Very good. Very interesting. I don't know why things changed. It's almost as if the space program and NASA became dominant, and then we were told what they wanted us to hear, and we stopped getting information about signals from Jupiter, Mars, signals from Saturn, signals from wherever. And these people who are recording these signals and locking in on them were not dumb. And the pictures of Mars were really extraordinary. They just went away. I mean, they were on the cover of Life magazine. I've seen that magazine somewhere.
Oh, yes. And there's also many instances of radio jammers claiming to be from other planets and cutting off powerful radio signals in Europe, Russia, and the United States with messages about nuclear disarmament and so forth. There was one individual that said he was a Venusian observation ranger.
Right.
And literally shut down the BBC with messages calling Earth and warning that we were playing with fire.
Well, we're certainly playing with it, all right. I just hope it doesn't burn us all up. We're really on the edge here of some really dumb things.
Here's another one that's interesting. This is the New York Times. This is March the 17th, 1968.
Mm-hmm.
Spooky signals from outer space.
There you go. There's another
one. And it's
one.
In New York Times, and it's a very long and extensive, well-written article. And remember, Walter Sullivan was the science editor of the New York Times at that, and he wrote the first serious book about the search for life on other planets. And then we didn't hear anything more about too much about him after that.
No, I think the mechanism was put together to control how we look at our own solar system as being empty, devoid of any other life, and, you know, the usual stuff.
Here's another good one. This is March the 30th of 1968. Danger from space civilization. Look to security, UN warned.
Well, there you are.
And these are from reputable newspapers that you could pick up in the newsstand back in the day, but you don't read this kind of stuff anymore.
It's all controlled.
Anymore.
Well, we've seen so many pictures from Mars that have been photoshopped, things have been smudged out. You have this crystal clear imagery, and all of a sudden it's smudgy. They have just gone through all those pictures, and we're being again shown what they want us to see. That's all. No more, no less. Complete captive audience. Well, Dr. Ray, thank you again for being here. Always fun. And do a research for all if you have time out there. The canals on Mars. Look for photographs of the canals on Mars. They used to have maps of these things. I mean, they would appear every year like clockwork on Mars.
Yes, I remember that. And going back all the way to 1877 with the astronomer Schiaparelli, and then Percival Lowell out in Arizona. I mean, they had this big passion about that very subject.
Exactly.
They wouldn't let up on it. And Percival Lowell financed out of his own pocket research on Mars, and even wrote a book about the possibility of life there and an advanced civilization. So this is real stuff.
Right, exactly. Ray, thank you again. It's good to talk to you as always. We'll look forward to our next conversation. Thanks for sharing, and have a good weekend. Great
job.
Thank
you, Jeff, and a happy Easter to you and your family and to all the listeners out there.
Thank you. Same to you, Ray. All righty. Good night.
Good night.
All right, Dr. Raymond Keller is a real gentleman. Okay, we will be back with more after this.